ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Colby Middlemass from ABC Cricket Podcast. And in case you missed it, the Ashes are on this summer. The Australia and England rivalry has never been bigger, so ABC Cricket Podcast is going bigger too. Join me and former Test opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, and after every day of play for the best analysis in cricket. If you want every angle of the Ashes covered in depth, ABC Cricket Podcast is for you. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley. This week I'm speaking with ABC presenters and journalists about their best stories and interviews from 2025. I'm joined by Alan Kohler, Lee Sales, Matt Bevan and Sarah Ferguson. Today it's Stephanie March from the ABC's Foreign Correspondent Program on her heartwarming and heartbreaking global stories. Steph, the greatest thing about Foreign Correspondent, the program, is that it takes the audience, it takes us, to places that we'd never get to go to largely. And, you know, you spend a lot of time meeting really different people that we'd never get to meet.
It's the best job in the ABC. Just don't tell anyone.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fantastic job and it's a fantastic opportunity, I think, to help people try and understand the world. We've never been more connected through our phones, through social media, but I feel like that doesn't necessarily equate to understanding, especially the way people consume things in such often short snippets. Mm. And I think what we get to do for Foreign Correspondent with half an hour of television is sort of show that things are rarely black and white, that there's a big grey area, and sometimes understanding that nuance and trying to understand why people are the way they are or do what they do or why places are the way they are can help generate a greater understanding and then hopefully a bit more empathy. Mm. And it might sound a bit Pollyanna-ish, but I think, you know, that's what might save us.
Yeah, and by the way, television is very easy to watch, Steph, but it's pretty hard to make.
Yes.
It does take a lot of time and a lot of filming. So thank you for doing that on our behalf. Anyway, let's travel the world with you then. Now, you started the year camping with elephants. Lucky you.
It was phenomenal. Once in a lifetime opportunity in Botswana.
Wow.
So Botswana is a remarkable part of southern Africa. It's got national parks with some of the highest game concentrations anywhere on the continent. It's home to the Kalahari Desert and the Okavango Delta that floods in the wet season. It's just beautiful. And it's also home to the largest number of elephants on the planet.
Welcome to Chobe National Park. Chobe National Park covers about 11,700 square kilometres.
Do you ever get tired of coming into the park every day for work?
Oh no, every day it's new for me.
It's 31 degrees and Chobe's elephants are looking for respite.
They put the mud into their body for cooling and also to protect their skin from the sunburn.
They're very clever.
Very clever animals.
But what you found is this is a huge challenge for the locals, isn't it? They're really struggling to live side by side with these elephants.
Yeah, I mean, the backstory to the elephant revival in Botswana is fascinating. So the numbers were really on the decline. In the 80s, up until about the 90s, there was huge amounts of poaching. There was a lot of conflict in the region, elephants, you know, sometimes getting literally caught in the crossfire. And then Botswana started this sort of conservation program that was pretty heavy-handed, whereby they had the military, you know, out there confronting poachers, and that led to this sort of huge rise in the number of elephants to 130,000 of them. And at the same time, the number of people in Botswana doubled as well to 2.6 million.
And while people can be a danger, of course, to elephants, it goes the other way too, doesn't it? Because there are people losing their lives because of the sheer increase in the number of elephants.
Yeah, so a lot of people in Botswana are subsistence farmers. Botswana has one of the highest income inequality rates on the continent of Africa. And obviously, animals and farmers compete for the same resources, for water, for land. So a lot of the conflict happens when, during harvest season, elephants come and raid people's crops.
It's the elephants Kafirwe worries about.
Now when it's time for harvest, they come to destroy the crops. They don't even leave even one crop for you to eat. They just take the whole farm. This is the fence that has been destroyed by elephants. The elephants now is their corridor. It's their entrance now. Enter here and go to our farms.
It is very, very painful. The elephant just destroy it in a minute, in a day.
There's very little they can do to stop them. Elephants are enormous and they, you know, travel in herds. And a lot of people don't have the resources. You know, sometimes they might have electric fences, but the solar panels break. Elephants can break through the fences. We meet one farmer in our story who's pretty much left with a stick and a bell.
Now, if an elephant comes to raid their crops, this is their best defense.
This is my gun. When I hit this elephant, when we hear the noise, it go back.
People, they are fed up, they've given up. As you see, they no longer farm. It's just me. It's scary. But you need to be brave. With elephants, they kill.
And so over the last decade or so, it's hard to get exact numbers, about 100 people have been killed or injured due to interactions with elephants.
All right. So tourists, we can't get enough of them, of course, elephants. Locals, as you're saying, are really struggling with the sheer numbers that are now there. And disturbingly, I suppose, to contain the numbers, in 2019, trophy hunting was reintroduced. So just tell me about that, because you actually went and met one of these trophy hunters or went on a hunt with him.
So we went out with a trophy hunter, Leon Kaschelhofer. He's a professional hunter who takes clients from abroad on weeks-long trips to essentially hunt and kill elephants.
Leon and tracker Moshongo have found some elephant footprints.
Do what I do, no more talking, no stepping and making loud noises. And if we get up to the elephant or suddenly come upon the elephant, I'll stop. But don't run. Nobody need to run. Just stand dead still.
Now, people will pay tens of thousands, up to $100,000 to do that. And essentially, the idea is that trophy hunting brings money into these communities that are otherwise having to bear the brunt of living alongside elephants. So it creates jobs for the trackers. Mm. It creates jobs for the people who are turning these elephant tusks once they're killed into trophies. And the idea is also that the money generated goes, some of it goes to government and then comes back out to local community projects and also to environmental programs. And going on this hunt, I can't say I understand why people do it, but we did get a real sense of the threat that these animals pose to humans, to locals. Mm. Anyway, we got up to these elephants that were drinking at a waterhole, and Leon sort of made a noise to let them know that we were there. And one of them kind of started flapping its ears and looked as if it was going to potentially charge. So Leon started making heaps and heaps of noise to scare it away, and eventually the elephant, you know, backed down and ran off into the bush.
Being this close to an angry elephant is confronting.
And I let him know that we're here, but imagine that bull coming at...
It's huge.
Yeah, coming
it's
at
terrifying.
40 kilometers. Yeah.
When it puts its... Yeah.
And now
we're
standing here with video cameras and a high-caliber rifle. Imagine a villager that's walking around looking for lost cattle, you know, or at night trying to keep these elephants out of their fields at night. And they've got nothing. They've got a stick, maybe a drum, and that's it. They're completely defenseless.
Wow.
Completely defenseless.
But just to point out, there are groups that are really trying to help communities, aren't there? So they can actually live alongside these animals without having to actually kill them.
Yeah, and people in Botswana have a really mixed relationship, I think, with elephants. Like, they do love them, but they also find them really difficult to live with.
For Leongo Motlekeleso, elephants make it hard for him to provide for his little family.
We are surrounded by elephants every day. We don't benefit anything from them. They are the ones benefiting from us. During the night, they break in, they eat. Sometimes we wake up in the morning and find nothing. Elephants are terrorists, they're terrorizing us.
But they do love them as well. And we spent time with Oitsinawa, who is from the Okavango Delta, runs an NGO called the Elephant Protection Society. And he just believes that the money generated from trophy hunting is so small, it goes to so few people, communities never really see a penny, it's not worth it. And what they should be investing in is getting communities involved in tourism and drawing people in to witness these beautiful animals in their natural habitat.
After people understand, like, we can benefit from this living or live elephant for some days, for some years, then they wouldn't kill the elephant. And then they'll start to respect the elephant. It's going to change their life.
And it was such a contrast. We went out with Oitsi as he was training a group of future safari guides, young men in their teens, to try and track elephants in a respectful and touristic way, not, you know, as if we're going to hunt them. And it was quite remarkable. He was so quiet, so gentle. And as we sort of came up upon this herd of elephants that had babies in there, which means they can get quite aggressive, instead of what Leon the hunter did, which was scream at them and yell and make as much noise as possible and wave his gun, Oitsi, who didn't have a gun at all, just told us all to stop, stay still, let the elephants pass, and they did.
Wow.
And it was just such a stark contrast. But the thing that stayed with me is the fact that both of these groups, both Oitsi and Leon Kaschelhofer, the hunter, both believe that what they're doing is absolutely the right thing to try and protect these elephants.
All right, well, Steph, from Botswana to Georgia. Once a darling of the West, of course, Georgia, but now it is, I think it's safe to say, a pretty concerning place to visit.
Yeah, so Georgia is in the Caucasus, so it's just south of Russia, near Ukraine, on the edge of the Black Sea, and it's a beautiful country as well. It's got these remarkable mountains, these sort of 6th century churches and buildings, all the way through to, you know, this fantastically brutalist Soviet architecture and European architecture. It's an amazing place. So Georgia was part of the Soviet Union, and then after it gained independence, it was sort of on the path of all these post-Soviet countries, you know, with an eye towards Europe. But in 2008, parts of Georgia were invaded by Russia, the separatist regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which created a great deal of instability and fear in Georgia for the people who realised that how vulnerable they were when it comes to their physical proximity to Russia, the size of Russia and the size of Georgia. And all we've seen then is this sort of slide from this very independent, pro-European, pro-EU democracy towards a sort of authoritarian, almost pro-Russia autocracy, and it's happening in real time.
Tell me about the man who's behind the current ruling partner, because he has pretty strong ties to Russia, doesn't he?
Yeah. So in 2012, the Georgian Dream Party won office in Georgia, and that's led by a billionaire oligarch, Bidzina Ivanishvili. He made his billions in Russia, and then he moved back to Georgia, essentially saying he was starting his party on a pro-EU platform. You know, the people of Georgia are so determined to join the European Union, it's enshrined in their constitution. And so Bidzina Ivanishvili and the Georgian Dream Party for many years were on this track to join the European Union. And then suddenly in 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, all of that changed. Bidzina Ivanishvili and his party started essentially saying that there were mysterious forces in the West trying to force Georgia into a second front with Russia, as Russia was fighting this war in Ukraine after it invaded Ukraine. They gave these mysterious forces a name, the Global War Party, and ever since then there's been this real turn against the EU, against European values, and the Georgian Dream Party have just made Georgia more and more and more draconian, even mimicking some of Russia's laws, you know, an anti-LGBT law. They've started jailing dissenters. They've started cracking down on journalists. They've made it very hard for foreign-funded NGOs to operate. And this has caused a great deal of alarm within Georgia and particularly within the West.
And there are people in Georgia who believe, Steph, that Russia is actually trying to take over Georgia.
Yeah, and it's sort of this, I suppose you'd call it a hybrid warfare. So one of the people we talked to is the former president of Georgia, Salome Zurabishvili. She was president for 6 years whilst the Georgian Dream Party were in government, and then they ousted her when she started criticising them essentially for being seemingly pro-Russia. And her view is that Russia has not really succeeded in Ukraine. The war is still going on. What it thought would be, you know, an easy takeover all the way to Kyiv has proved to really bog Russia's military down. So her view is that Russia is trying this new tactic of hybrid warfare.
What we are seeing establishing itself in Georgia, and what we are resisting, is a Russian-type regime. A new strategy by Russia through manipulation of elections, through propaganda, through a proxy government.
And her point is, if they're successful in Georgia, a country that is extremely savvy to the ways of Russia, being a former member of the Soviet Union, a former part of the Soviet Union, if they can do it in Georgia, they can do it anywhere. And there's definitely evidence of this hybrid warfare and influence campaigns happening all across the world.
Yeah, and, you know, this sort of goes unnoticed, doesn't it, around the world in a sense. But the consequences could be really, really alarming. And as you say, even during your time on the ground there, you could sort of see democracy eroding in real time, couldn't you?
Yeah, and it's really strange. Like, I've reported on this sort of Russian hybrid warfare before in the Arctic, and it's almost like you're being gaslit. You know, it's really difficult to see. One of the reasons we wanted to do this story in Georgia is because it's happening so fast. Mm. One of the people we met on one of our first nights there, they have these protests outside the parliament every single night. People all wear masks because people have been getting fined thousands of dollars for participating in these protests, for being on the streets. Some have been jailed. There's been violence at different points in time. And yet these protests continue for people who are pro-EU, who want democracy.
More protesters arrive chanting slogans against the government, which the European Parliament says cheated its way into power. It's passed repressive laws that mimic those in Russia, and it started jailing dissenters.
We met an opposition MP, Zurab Japaridze, at one of these protests. Our fixer just said, oh, that guy, he's an MP, you should go talk to him. But he's boycotting parliament. He doesn't want to be a part of a parliament that has Georgian Dream after these rigged elections, they say, being elected to power. And he essentially was saying he might end up in jail.
Oh,
and we were in Georgia for 2 weeks, and towards the end of our time, he had a court hearing, and we went to his court hearing, and at the end of it, he was handcuffed and taken to jail.
Oh,
and later on, we found out he was jailed for 7 months. And then just in November, the prosecutor's office in Georgia has said that they plan on filing more charges against him and some opposition politicians for sabotage and collaborating with foreign agents. And he could go to jail from anywhere between 7 and 15 years. And to me, that's just one example of the trajectory of what's happening in Georgia embodied in one person. You know, we spent time with his wife and kids.
Yes.
And it was heartbreaking as his wife, Nakhrudze, sat there saying, you know, I've told my kids that he's going to be in jail for a month, but I know it could be a year. You know, at this stage, she didn't know that it could potentially be up to 15 years.
And when I talked to Zura, you know, and I told him, you know, Do you realize how tough it's gonna be, you know, for kids? Let alone for myself, but he said that at least when they grow up, he said they will not be ashamed of me, so they will know that their father, you know, did the right thing. So.
It's not only the, you know, the bigger picture loss of democracy, but the impact on people's lives and freedoms.
Yes, and incredible that there are these people that are willing to fight for democracy and be jailed for it. Just an incredible story. Now, we know international journalists were banned and still are from going into Gaza, but you worked really closely with Gazan journalists on the ground to bring a story of incredible survival. Just tell me about the family that you followed there.
Yeah, we did an episode called Gaza, Children of War, because we wanted to find out what life was like for the kids who were still trying to survive in this horrific war zone. Almost every family in Gaza has been displaced at least once. Most now live in tents with no running water or electricity. For 8-year-old Suar and his 10-year-old brother Siraj, life here in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza is boring and uncomfortable.
Hi, Sira. Hi, Anna. Hi, Suar.
We worked with two remarkable Gazan journalists to follow families in Deir al-Balah in the south and in Gaza City. The family we met in Deir al-Balah, the Muhammad family, were very ordinary, and I think that's why it revealed a lot about what life is like. They lived in the north before the war. The dad actually had a work permit to work in Israel, which is, you know, quite a coveted thing. You can earn a decent wage. Mm. The mum was a mum, kindergarten teacher, and there was three kids. There's 10-year-old Siraj, 8-year-old Suar, and 5-year-old Sila. And they had been living in a tent for the best part of 2 years. And over that time, they spoke of how, I suppose particularly for the older boy, Siraj, his trust in the world had just been eroded and his sort of level of anger had just increased. You know, his mum talked about this, and so did he actually, how this one event really changed him, where he went to get up and go to the toilet in the night and a quadcopter, which is like a drone, you know, like a recreational drone, but in Gaza there are a lot of reports of them being armed with guns or bombs, started stalking him outside the toilet.
Marla.
And he was terrified and he ran back home, and his mum sort of said he's never been the same. And that's just one example of what these kids who were leading really normal lives, you know, they loved going to school. Palestinians have, before the war, one of the highest literacy rates in the world. 98% of Palestinians were literate. You know, they really pride themselves on things like education, and all that's been taken away by the war. And watching this family, particularly the dad, Ahmed, and the mum, Halima, try and retain a sense of dignity while living in a tent was quite remarkable. And to be honest, the thing that broke my heart was we filmed with them for months and we had hours and hours and hours of footage watching them, you know, try and stay clean when they don't have access to clean water, trying to keep their clothes clean, brush their hair, cook decent food when there's nothing available in the markets. And then just as we were finishing filming, they were forced out of the piece of land that they'd been on for 2 years because more people were fleeing Gaza City, and they ended up having to set up camp in just the ruins of this city further south, just surrounded by rubble and debris and, you know, yet again sort of picking up the pieces and trying to keep on keeping on. And it was a really, I think the ordinariness of them and the extraordinariness of their circumstances revealed a lot about what life is like in Gaza.
And they're the sort of stories that stay with you, right? I know from my own experience when children are involved, those stories matter.
Yeah, I mean, and you did some phenomenal reporting on children left behind, the surrogacy stories, and it's hard to accept why kids have to.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I mean,
this is all part of it. You feel it, don't you? And it's not just the Gaza story. You know, there's so many. It's why do kids have to bear the brunt of it? I think, and you know, it's hard. The situation in Gaza, you know, the war is over, which is remarkable, but more than half of Gazans are still homeless. You know, the IDF still occupy more than half of the Gazan territory. It's winter. You know, kids are going to be very, very cold, if not freezing, in their tents. It's sort of just, yeah, it's hard to know that just when you stop reporting on the story continues. Yeah. But I think it's still important that we do these stories, because even if they are just a moment in time, you know, they give people a window into what life is like. And I think for me, the other thing it always does is, oh, sorry, Sam.
No.
It makes me so grateful.
Yes.
For, it just makes me endlessly grateful.
Yeah.
For,
we are lucky people.
Yeah.
As Australians, yeah. Well, thank you for bringing us those pretty hard stories and fulfilling them, Steph. Wishing you, of course, the best holiday season, and I cannot wait to watch the stories you bring us next year. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. Sorry for turning into a blubbering mess on your podcast.
You are forgiven.
Thank you so much, and have a lovely holiday.
Thanks, Steph. Stephanie March is from the ABC's Foreign Correspondent Program. You can watch her investigations on ABC iView. Join me tomorrow on ABC News Daily. I'll be joined by Matt Bevan from If You're Listening on some of the weird characters in Trump's orbit. This episode was produced by Sydney Peed. Audio production by Cinnamon Nippard. Our supervising producer is David Coney. I'm Sam Hawley. Thanks for listening.